This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
U.S. involvement in Afghanistan is winding down. The Pentagon's pulling out military contractors, leaving some crucial vacancies.
Contractors do all of the work on bases, from cooking and cleaning to guarding. Many of the walls are not currently guarded by U.S. military.
Also today on the show, for climbers looking for the ultimate challenge, Mount Everest, now is not a good year. COVID is rapidly spreading at base camp in Nepal.
We could have a very, very, very bad tragedy this year.
And a new album is out today featuring rap, traditional, and pop tunes recorded by Iranians in exile to support the composers inside Iran.
To raise awareness about the persecution of artists and the increased censorship that they have to endure on a regular basis.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Welcome to the show on this Friday. More big news in the vaccine world today. The World Health Organization is endorsing China's Sinopharm vaccine for emergency use,
making it the sixth vaccine to receive WHO validation for safety, efficacy, and quality.
WHO Director Tedros Ghebreyesus made the announcement this afternoon. Sinopharm is now the first coronavirus vaccine from a non-Western country to get the green light. Ghebreyesus said the approval will expand vaccine options for COVAX. That's the main global vaccine distribution program designed to help low-income countries.
We are in an unprecedented crisis that requires unprecedented action.
One selling point for the Sinopharm vaccine, it can be stored in a standard refrigerator. That makes it more attractive to developing countries. But here's the big knock on Sinopharm. Its effectiveness has been questioned, even from within China at one point. Still, a WHO review panel said they had enough evidence to conclude that the vaccine is safe and highly effective at preventing severe cases of COVID-19. Another unknown, though, WHO advisor Dr. Bruce Aylward said today they don't know yet how soon and how much China will be able to scale up supplies.
As you can imagine, I think we need to hear from the company itself what their actual numbers will be, but they are looking at trying to provide substantial support.
Nepal was one of the first Asian nations to receive vaccines from the COVAX program. It's struggling with an outbreak right now and needs more vaccines. We're going to focus on one small outbreak there at the base camp for climbers heading up Mount Everest. The Nepalese side of the mountain has been open for a few weeks. It did not take long for COVID to appear. And as the world's Bianca Hillier reports, the problem is only getting worse.
Climber Arlen Ness says he wasn't all that worried about COVID-19 as he made his way from Norway to Nepal at the very beginning of April.
We discussed the situation, but the conclusion was that it was very low infection level there. We're not worried, and we didn't see or hear anything about COVID or infections.
After touching down in Kathmandu, Ness and his team set off on the 9-day hike to base camp. During that trek, Ness started feeling weak. His symptoms only got worse the higher he climbed. Still, Ness says a COVID diagnosis wasn't really on his radar.
No one talked about COVID. Maybe my guide, day two, when he came into my tent with two masks, then I start thinking.
Days later, Ness was evacuated by helicopter to a hospital in Kathmandu. He tested positive for COVID-19 and became the first known case from Everest Base Camp this season. When Canadian climber Leo Naiman arrived at base camp a few days later, word of Ness's diagnosis had gotten around. Naiman says he knew it wasn't a good sign.
I'm going to be honest with you. I've been in other base camps in the past, and if one person gets flu, basically the entire base camp gets flu. So it was a very, very strong concern about it.
Naaman says some COVID safety measures are in place at base camp. Expedition teams have to stay in roped-off areas, and most people comply. But it hasn't been enough to stop the spread.
Well, the conditions are bad.
Dr. Hermann Brueger is the president of the International Society for Mountain Medicine. He's in touch with doctors on Everest now and says the main problem they're facing is not being able to differentiate COVID-19 from common altitude sicknesses, including high-altitude pulmonary edema, known as HAPE.
If they would have testing possibilities, they could say, okay, this is COVID, this is HAPE. But at the moment, they have no antigen tests and no PCR. So therefore, for the medical staff, it's quite difficult.
An official with the Himalayan Rescue Association told the BBC this week that 17 climbers have tested positive for COVID-19 after being evacuated off the mountain. A separate organization, the Nepal Mountaineering Association, confirmed only 3 cases. And so far, the Nepalese government has denied any positive cases at base camp. The country's Department of Tourism, which granted a record number of permits for Everest this year, did not reply to my request for comment. Here's Canadian Leo Naaman again.
It's one thing what the government is saying, and it's a different thing that might be happening. In reality, COVID-19 is rapidly spreading in base camp. We could have a very, very, very bad tragedy this year.
Naaman was at base camp for 10 days before being evacuated with a stomach infection. I asked him about the support crews and Sherpas he encountered, and if they were talking about being scared of getting sick but needing the money.
Everyone. All the Sherpas.
Naaman says the risk that local Sherpas take for international climbers like him stood out under this year's worsened conditions.
I was in tears, for example, when I saw a guy bringing, stumbling with a ping pong table to base camp. I was honestly in tears. And I said, I'm crying because I see what we have become.
More than 1,000 people are expected to pass through base camp over the next month. But Dr. Brueger with the International Society for Mountain Medicine doesn't expect the season to last that long.
I suppose in a few weeks, Everest base camp will be empty, because the risk of getting COVID is quite high because there are so many people there. So therefore, I don't see any chance to continue.
Climber Arlen Ness is now back home in Norway, recovered from COVID-19. Hindsight, he says, is 2020.
I think it was not right to open Everest. I think Nepal actually should have canceled the whole season.
Nepal's crisis isn't isolated to Everest. Daily cases peak today, with nearly 9,000 positive tests, according to the WHO. Doctors say the country is in a similar situation as neighboring India was a few weeks ago. Prime Minister KP Sharma Oli, who has faced criticism for his handling of the pandemic, is looking for international help.
Since we are living in an interconnected and interlinked world, pandemic like this spares no one and no one is safe.
In a televised address this week, the Prime Minister asked foreign donors to send vaccines and medical equipment to Nepal. The International Federation of Red Cross says global action is urgently needed to prevent a worsening human catastrophe across South Asia. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Rio de Janeiro yesterday, a police raid targeting suspected drug traffickers turned deadly. It shocked the neighborhood where it happened and is believed to be the deadliest police operation in the history of Rio. Residents and local officials are accusing the police of using excessive force and are now demanding an investigation. From Brazil, Michael Fox has the latest.
Yesterday, the residents of the poor Jacarezinho favela on the north end of Rio de Janeiro woke up to this. Gunfire. And this. Police helicopters spin over the neighborhood in this video posted on Twitter by the local Jacarezinho media team, Labjaca. "That's a problem," says a man off camera. "Those guys are shooting down on the neighborhood from up above." 200 officers participated in the police raid. "We're stuck inside, suffocating from the tear gas, and we can't go out," one resident posted on Twitter. As the hours passed, the body count rose. When the bullets stopped flying, residents poured from their homes to protest. "Murderers!" dozens of young women shout in this video live streamed over social media. They marched through the narrow streets of the neighborhood chanting, "Justice, justice, justice." All told, it was the deadliest Rio de Janeiro police operation ever. 25 people were killed, including one police officer. 3 people were injured. 2 commuters were hit by stray bullets on a passing train. At an afternoon press conference, civil police said they had prepared the raid for 10 months and had gone in to arrest 21 members of a criminal gang accused of enticing children and adolescents into drug trafficking. They said they had detained 10 people, followed all protocols, but didn't celebrate the high death count. For residents, the day was a nightmare. That's a mother who lost her son in a video shared online. "They pointed the gun at me and said I was going to die," she says. Other women by her side keep repeating, "Killers, killers." Joel Luis Costa is a lawyer who grew up in Jacarezinho. He spent the afternoon witnessing the aftermath and collecting testimonies from residents.
Isso aqui não é democracia. Eu só falando que caralho, isso aqui é cenário de guerra e a gente não merece.
This is not democracy, Costa tells the camera in a Twitter video. His eyes are bloodshot from the tears. He's wearing a gray suit and tie. A surgical face mask hangs over one ear. This is a war scene, and we don't deserve to live in a war scene. He said he visited 5 or 6 homes. He says they all look the same. Homes turned upside down. Execution-style shots. There were no signs of crossfire. A boy was killed sitting in a chair. You don't fire back when you're sitting in a chair. This was an execution, he says. Calls for investigations have echoed across the city, from local officials to members of the city's public defenders.
Não temos pena de morte no Brasil. E, portanto, não é...
In this video, over social media, Rio de Janeiro Legislative Assembly member Renata Souza says, "We don't have the death penalty in Brazil, and therefore it's not up to the police to decide who should die and who should live in our society. We had a slaughter in Jacarezinho today, and it needs to be investigated," she said. This was not the first violent police operation in Rio's favelas. According to the figures, police in Rio have killed roughly 150 people each month this year. But the police raids, they shouldn't even be taking place. Last June, due to the pandemic, Brazil's Supreme Court banned all Rio de Janeiro police operations in poor communities except in the most extreme circumstances. The impact in the following months was unprecedented. Police killings dropped by 66%. The number of violent and nonviolent crimes also sank, according to a paper released last month by Jesse Bullock, a PhD candidate at Harvard University.
In some ways, it's actually a little surprising to me how effective it was initially in the first 90 days after the ruling. And the more time passes, as we see that the police gradually started to disrespect the ruling and discount it.
Bullock says that Rio's police justify their violence as a necessary means for securing the city.
They think the only way to fight trafficking and to decrease organized crime is with these types of operations and with and like fighting force with force. This was even something that Bolsonaro himself campaigned on, that force, you fight force with force slogan.
Police say they've done everything by the books. And critics say that, in a twisted way, that's true. Fabiana da Silva works with the Rio de Janeiro Human Rights Ombudsman Office, and she grew up in a favela in northern Rio de Janeiro.
Extremamente normal, assim. É uma coisa tão absurda.
She says, the police are acting totally normal. Totally normal. It's so absurd. In April, there was a public hearing about police operations in the favelas. The same day there were raids in 2 different favelas, she says. The Supreme Court has set a date for later this month to discuss the Rio de Janeiro police operations. Many hope the calls for investigations lead to action and to accountability for this police raid and the ones to come. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
The U.S. military is getting out, and so are the government contractors. Where that leaves Afghanistan right now, that's just ahead. And later on the show, short supplies of Canadian timber mean expensive DIY in the U.S. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The U.S. military is leaving Afghanistan with the full pullout by September 11th. Already, American and NATO forces have started handing over military bases to Afghan forces. Here's Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, speaking at a press conference yesterday.
To date, we have closed one base in Helmand. Approximately 60 C-17 equivalents have departed with various equipment and rolling stock, and over 1,300 pieces of equipment have been transferred either to the Defense Logistics Agency for destruction or to the ANSF for their use.
ANSF, that's the Afghan National Security Forces. The World's Shirin Jafari is following the story. Shirin, what is the latest with the pullout?
Marco, as the U.S. begins to leave Afghanistan, the Taliban has been steadily increasing its attacks in different parts of the country. Usually around this time of year, the Taliban starts what it calls its spring offensive. And it looks like this year they are going in with full force. Just yesterday, the Taliban fighters took over Afghanistan's second largest dam in Kandahar City. That's in the southern parts of the country. And they have also captured a district in Baghlan province in the north. There is intense fighting in Helmand province as well. Today, I managed to reach Sarah Leahy. She's with the medical NGO Doctors Without Borders. She's based in Helmand province, and this is what she told me.
We've treated 76 war-wounded patients between May 3rd and 5th in our emergency room with gunshot and shrapnel wounds. And many of them have told us about how they've had such difficulties accessing the hospital because the roads are blocked. So it's also very dangerous for them to leave their homes.
Shirin, that does not sound good and does not bode well for after September. Why has the Taliban stepped up its attacks?
Well, partly because, like I said, springtime is fighting season. The weather gets warmer and the roads become more accessible. Fighters start to move around the country more easily. And the Taliban is also clearly wanting to have an edge on the battlefield so that when the Americans are gone, they have the upper hand, not just militarily, but also politically. General Mark Milley said yesterday that there have been at least between 80 to 120 attacks a day recently. None of them against American forces, he said, but mostly against Afghan security forces and civilians.
Another interesting development this week, comments by General Milley and Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin that the U.S. is also pulling out all of its contractors from Afghanistan. What more do we know about that?
Yeah, as you know, Marco, the U.S. has relied heavily on contractors for the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Sometimes there have been more contractors on the ground than U.S. military forces. I spoke with Noah Coburn about this. He has written a book about contractors in Afghanistan.
Contractors do all of the work on bases, from cooking and cleaning to guarding. Many of the walls are not currently guarded by U.S. military, but they also do logistics. They run HR. They run the IT department.
And he said these contractors are a mix of nationalities. There are Afghans, Americans, and some of them from places like Nepal, India, and Bangladesh.
So what's going to happen to these contractors who work for the Americans as the U.S. bases close down?
That's a very important question, Marco, because the fate of these contractors really depend on their nationality. If they're American, they will probably go back to the U.S. or find another job elsewhere. Coburn told me about some of the contractors he has been following for his book.
I did speak to several who, for example, are now providing security at oil refineries in Africa. Casinos in China, for example, I've heard rely on Nepali security at times as well.
It's a different situation for the Afghans. They could be in a lot of danger because of the work they've done with the U.S. military. They are now targets. The Taliban considers the U.S. to be the enemy, and it has in the past said it will target and kill Afghans who have worked with the Americans. The U.S. does have a visa program that helps some of these contractors come to the U.S., but for many Afghans, the process has been slow and unreliable.
And the pullout continues. The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for your reporting.
You're welcome, Marco.
In March 2020, violinist and singer Maria Ramos was in New Zealand touring with her band, the all-female mariachi group Flor de Toloache. Then the pandemic hit. Ramos explains what happened next.
We started our tour with Flor de Toloache, with my band, in January. then we had an extensive tour until March, until we came here to Australia and New Zealand to do a festival that's called WOMAD, which is a world music festival. Our last show was on a Sunday. I think it was March 16th, around then. And on Monday, we were supposed to catch our flight back home. And when I wake up, after we performed the night before, my partner is like, we're going to stay here. We're going to stay in New Zealand. Things are too crazy. We're not taking a flight right now. You know, we don't know if we're going to get stuck somewhere. So it was all really like chaotic. So we thought, you know, the whole thing was going to be done in a month or two. And here we are, a year later, we're still here. I've been lucky to, well, we're all lucky as our artists in this generation and this time to have all these platforms where we can continue to create and talk to each other and bounce ideas and also bounce recordings. So as a band, we've been able to continue to collaborate. We've done tons of virtual shows, but we did one specifically in the beginning of this year that became our next album. And it's all like rock covers, but in the mariachi, you know, version, toloache version. Each person is doing their part. First, we do like we record our audio, and then my partner puts it all together, and then we'll all make the videos individually. What's cool about it is that when I do get the audio of the other ladies and I hear them in my ear, it's just like, you know, I feel connected to them, and it makes them miss them more. And it's just beautiful that we can still do those things. So for Valentine's Day, I promoted this Valentine's Day Serenatas, virtual serenades. I offered, you know, serenatas, and it was pretty popular. People started booking their little serenades, and it was really cute. It was so, so sweet. Like, just to see the different, like, you know, gifts, you know, that and how people got emotional and how they would cry, you know, to receive this gift of music. So yeah, I wanted to do it again for Mother's Day, because a lot of people, even if you're vaccinated, don't get to see their families and their moms. So people are booking their serenatas. So that's pretty cool.
A reunion is on the horizon. Flor de Toloache plans to tour in the U.S. in person this August. You're with the world. Nearly 4,000 people dying every day. That's what India is facing with COVID. Healthcare workers are taxed beyond exhaustion.
They have been working tirelessly for the last 1 year, and this wave, the second wave as we call here, is like a tsunami.
The numbers may be starting to come down. More on that just ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 99 years ago, Ireland was split into a Catholic-majority republic in the south and a Protestant majority in the north. The northern part remained in the United Kingdom. Decades of conflict followed. In 1998, a hard-won peace finally stopped the fighting, but now a new debate over Ireland's future is heating up. Blame a realignment of the British Isles due to Brexit, the UK out of the European Union, but the Republic of Ireland in the EU. As Andrew Connolly reports from Belfast in Northern Ireland, the tension goes even deeper than that.
Of all the complexities involved in Brexit, Robin Mercer never thought it would stop him importing flowers.
The same roses that we brought in from England, we've had to bring them from the south of Ireland to top them up, and they're 20% dearer. So prices have actually gone up.
In the 80 years since Mr. Mercer's grandfather founded the Hillmount Garden Centre on the outskirts of Belfast, the business has never faced as many obstacles as they do now.
But, you know, all these garden centres, like, we're all family businesses, we're all working hard. You know, we can't afford to have three staff just sitting in an office. It's a ridiculous amount of paperwork.
After Brexit, doing custom checks on Northern Ireland's land border with EU member Ireland was deemed politically sensitive and logistically challenging. The compromise, known as the Northern Ireland Protocol, keeps the North under EU trading regulations. Now, goods like seeds and plants coming from mainland Britain are checked at Northern Irish ports instead, and it's a lot of administrative costs for small businesses like Hillmount.
Welcome to the Port of Rath.
Beyond garden centres, the protocol is aggravating the region's fragile political and constitutional order. It's also causing disruption at the port of Larne, north of Belfast, where goods from mainland Britain are now checked.
I asked for a book to come in through Amazon from another part, United Kingdom, and it had to go through customs. This is ridiculous. We are still part of United Kingdom.
That's Councillor Paul Reid from the Democratic Unionist Party, staunch advocates of keeping Northern Ireland in the UK. They share power with Sinn Féin, who campaigned for a united Ireland. For Mr. Reid, any kind of border between the United Kingdom threatens Northern Ireland's identity. People here are angry after broken promises by high-ranking politicians.
I want to make it absolutely clear that will I allow the EU or anyone else to create any kind of division down the Irish Sea or to attenuate our union?
That's Boris Johnson speaking in Northern Ireland in 2019. Since custom checks began this year, the harbour has become a focal point for a series of sinister events by people who see the protocol as a betrayal. One port worker was allegedly rehoused after receiving threats. Protesters threw rocks at police. Graffiti appeared reading all port staff are targets. Local councillor Danny Donnelly from the Opposition Alliance Party helped to get it removed.
I think it's disgusting that any workers are targeted, and they absolutely should not be. Everybody should feel safe going to their work and doing their job. I think some people feel very strongly about the Northern Ireland Protocol. They feel it infringes their identity. But the Northern Ireland Protocol is the result of Brexit. You know, it is the reality of Brexit in Northern Ireland.
In late March, 12 days of rioting spread across towns and cities in Northern Ireland. 90 police officers were injured and nearly 20 people arrested. Children as young as 13 set cars alight and threw petrol bombs and stones at police. It was the worst street violence in several years. Some commentators blamed the protocol. But were children really motivated by a complex international trade agreement? In Belfast, the unrest occurred largely in working-class Protestant neighbourhoods loyal to the United Kingdom. In areas like the Shankill Road, where Mary McDermott works as a senior psychotherapist, communities are effectively segregated and dare not stray into each other's patch.
From their very young age, you have to be careful what your name is, because your name can tell you if you're a Catholic or a Protestant.
Northern Ireland is a post-conflict society. McDermott says that intergenerational trauma, combined with poverty and deprivation, creates fertile ground for clashes.
Again, these kids have been neglected in many ways. And then we're dealing with the drugs and alcohol. We've got parental substance misuse, neglect, the suicide alone. Again, the sectarianism and the trauma we've talked about, lack of employment as well for the kids that are leaving school, lack of opportunities.
Miles of walls and fences still separate Catholic and Protestant communities, some up to 13 metres high and linked by gates, which are locked at night. Driving a few hundred yards from the Shankill Road to the Falls Road, the Union Jack flags suddenly become Irish tricolours. The murals are similar, vivid images of balaclava-clad, gun-toting paramilitaries. They just switch from loyalist to Republican. In this stark atmosphere, criminal gangs with political connections can stir up tension at a moment's notice.
What we've seen up there in those rats were kids being exploited, kids being coerced, and being bullied, threatened, bribed. Like, we have stories of kids getting bags of drugs if they threw paddle bombs.
Stephen Hughes is a senior youth worker at the St. Peter's Immaculata Youth Centre. His staff were on the front line when the riots erupted, trying to stop young people from getting sucked into the violence and help them find common ground.
And what they suddenly realise is, the kid on the other side of that wall is so alike to me, it's unbelievable. Yes, they may have a constitutional difference. Yes, they may have a faith difference. But in the main, it's not enough to keep them divided.
Stephen Hughes thinks that Brexit is not the cause of the unrest, but it heightens the pre-existing tensions.
If you speak to our kids tell you, this is your problem. This is your generation created this. We want something different. We don't want your walls. We don't want your hate. Do you know, but what we're seeing now in the last couple of months from this Brexit debacle has come along is that it's being used, it's being weaponized, and it's being used to divide our community. And trust me, there's no benefit in dividing us. The consequences could be quite scary, actually.
Throughout its turbulent history, the people of Northern Ireland have been forced to take a side. Brexit has only deepened those divisions, and the feeling of abandonment by the British government is widespread. Demographic shifts and polling indicate a referendum on Irish unification could be likely within the next decade or two. So that feeling of abandonment could end the United Kingdom altogether. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly in Belfast.
If you've taken advantage of lockdowns to do some DIY work at home, you may have already noticed this. The cost of wood is at an all-time high in North America. That's partly due to increased demand from the spike in home improvement projects. Supplies of North American timber have also tanked in recent years, in places like the forests of Western Canada. Janice Cook is a forest biologist at the University of Alberta and joins me now. So why is supply of lumber so low right now? I guess there might be a beetle to blame.
We have had, over the past 20 years, an unprecedented outbreak of a beetle called mountain pine beetle that has impacted 27 million hectares of pine forests. That's the size of Washington State or Oklahoma that has been devastated by this beetle in British Columbia alone.
Why has this outbreak of these mountain pine beetles been so bad?
Well, we had an unfortunate collision of events that took place. Some of these can be attributed to climate change. Two of the events that occurred that have continued to impact the progression of the outbreak were warmer than usual, overwintering temperatures. Living here in northern Canada, I can tell you that it gets pretty cold, but the colder it gets, the more beetles we kill. And we had a number of winters where we just didn't get those really, really, really cold temperatures that knock those populations back. Number two was a series of hot, dry summers. And those hot, dry summers compromise the abilities of pines to defend themselves against these invading beetles.
For the North American lumber market, Janice, how important are the forests of Western Canada?
They are our wood basket of Canada, and the losses of the pine forests to that timber market is really a blow.
You're from Prince George, British Columbia, Janice, a city that relies heavily on forestry. So you're not just invested in this as a biologist. I imagine this must also be personal for you.
That's correct. I was born and raised in Prince George. I still have family there. Growing up, virtually every family that I knew was involved in the forest industry in one way or another, including my own family. Although I haven't lived in Prince George now for more years than I care to say on the radio, I still have many friends and family in the area that are intimately tied to the forest industry. When we think about that loss of timber, we're talking about mill closures, communities that for many, many decades have relied on those forests. And now that chain is in danger of breaking. Like every resource industry, forestry towns see huge booms and they also see huge busts. And we've seen busts before, but this time feels different.
So this is really an economic and an environmental story. What is the way forward, Janice, for British Columbia forestry, do you think? Is there anything that can be done?
There is. Building resilient forests is about making careful choices, best informed choices, science informed choices of what trees go out on the landscape. What does that forested landscape look like? How do we structure our forests to not only withstand mountain pine beetle in the future, but all of these other pests and pathogens and natural disturbances that are an increasing threat under climate change? What can we do to encourage growth of a resilient forest, and hopefully by having resilient forests, having resilient communities?
Janice, did you become a forest biologist because you grew up like right in the middle of it?
Well, that is a subject of a whole other interview. But when I went to university, I said there was no way was I going to get involved. But at the time that I was making those decisions, we were entering a new era of forest biology where we could use new tools to make forest management decisions. And it was those new tools that really spoke to me and said, you know, if I return to the forestry domain, maybe using those new tools, we could make a difference.
Janice Cook is a forest biologist at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. Thanks very much for discussing this with us.
Thank you very much, Marco, and thank you very much for having me on The World.
Things are not letting up for India. Yesterday, a new single-day high in COVID cases there, more than 400,000 people infected, nearly 4,000 dead in one day. Those are just the reported figures. Many experts say the actual numbers are substantially higher. Over the past few weeks on the show, we've tried to establish a better picture of the crisis in India. Today, the view of a doctor attending to the sick, Dr. Anil Gulati, joins me. He's in India's capital, New Delhi, where he's working in a hospital that right now is only taking care of COVID patients. Dr. Gulati, what is it like to be a healthcare worker right now in India?
It's really a very stressful job. All the healthcare workers are really tired. And this wave, the second wave, as we call here, is like a tsunami. The whole healthcare team is physically, emotionally, they're all drained out. And the sheer numbers are overwhelming. And the hospital systems just cannot handle such numbers.
What is your personal experience? What does your day look like typically?
I, being a little older in age, I'm not really on the exact front line, as you call it. The younger group is what is handling the critically ill patients. And those people are really working day in and day out. And you just don't know where you are. You have hordes of people coming with oxygen cylinders in their hands, the relatives holding the supplies. Some people are in the cars. Some people are outside the hospital. So the situation in Delhi continues to be grim, but for the last 3 to 4 days, we find some respite, no doubt about it. The lockdown for the last 3 weeks has really been of great value. So there is a definite decline, and I'm very hopeful in the next 3 to 4 weeks, we should have some reasonable control over what is going on.
You spoke about the sick who are with their relatives and trying to find a bed in an ICU, so hospitals are overwhelmed. Where do patients go then? What are they left to do?
People run from pillar to post, wherever they find some place. Even small medical units, which are not so well equipped, are also handling, and whatever first aid or preliminary treatment they can give, they are doing their best. But fortunately, for the last 24 hours in the city of Delhi, there is some respite and the adequate quota of oxygen is now available. So I'll say things are a little better, but certainly nowhere near what a human being is entitled to in year 2021.
Have you been worried, or are you worried now about your own health, your own safety?
No doubt about it. Every patient that you meet is a potential person who can infect you. And when you get infected, your whole family gets infected, and it can be a disaster. But fortunately, many of the healthcare workers, or most of them, I'll say, in the town of Delhi, have got 2 doses. They are suffering, no doubt, from illnesses, but the disease is manageable.
So what else could be done right now to help stop the surge in cases and deaths? Like, if you were advising the government, what would you tell them?
First is take care of people who are sick, augment the healthcare supplies, take care of the oxygen. The lockdown should continue for another 2 weeks to 3 weeks minimum. There should be adequate supply of vaccines. It's like carpet bombing of the whole city or the whole town with the vaccines so that more people do not get affected. The government should be more proactive and should take care of the citizens much better than it has done in the past few weeks. At the same time, the whole world has shown solidarity with the country. So if everybody is helping us, we should also take adequate care and we should do our best.
Anil Gulati is a doctor based in New Delhi, speaking with us about the current COVID-19 surge in India. Dr. Gulati, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
We've taken you all over the globe on the world this week, to Europe to find out how and when U.S. tourists might be welcome, to Latin America to learn how geothermal energy is climate friendly, and we broke down why China's naval forays led one foreign minister in Southeast Asia to drop the F-bomb on social media. If you missed any of these stories, we've got you covered. Spend some time with us at theworld.org. In Iran these days, Western pop music is more easily available than it used to be, but Iranian musicians continually find themselves censored and jailed, and many of them refuse to be silenced. There's a new album by some of these Iranian artists that's out today. Singers like the single named Nikita are trying to raise awareness about the muzzle the Iranian government is putting on artists. The compilation is titled Humanity and was produced by the organizations Crowdsourcing Human Rights and the Democracy Council. Marjan Kapoor Greenblatt is a human rights activist and part of the team that curated Humanity. She joins us now from New York. Tell us about the song we're listening to by Nikita.
The song is an ode to Iran. It is a nostalgia and it's a love song for Iran.
So tell us more about the idea behind this project, Humanity, and why you're doing it now.
The persecution of artists and musicians in Iran is not a new thing. But when Crowdsourcing Human Rights was established, a group of artists, activists who care very much about the situation in Iran decided to raise awareness about the persecution of artists and the increased censorship that they have to endure on a regular basis.
As a work of protest, how many of these artists actually live inside Iran and how many of them are either in exile or outside the country?
Most of the artists who are contributing and participating on Humanity are in exile. But what is beautiful about this album is that the songs are written and the lyrics are coming from artists inside Iran who would not have otherwise been able to perform the songs on their own with their own voices.
I'd like you to introduce us to a couple more of the artists on the album, but first the title Humanity. I mean, it sounds like a play on words on humanity, but I gather there's also a reference to Persian mythology, right?
Absolutely. The Homa bird is omnipresent in many of Iranian mythology, and it has always been a bird of compassion and kindness. But also something about Homa bird is that it represents a flock of birds that are flying together, and together they are more powerful. And that's exactly a good symbol for our album. You know, one song can have its own beauty and its message, but in a compilation, we are a Homa bird. We are a flock of birds flying together and hopefully bringing a little bit of awareness and compassion to what the artists have to go through.
So let's hear from a couple more of the artists on the album Humanity, starting with Behrouz Gaimi. What can you tell us about Behrouz?
Behrouz is based in the UK. He started out as an event performer playing at weddings and events where they had to actually obtain proper license and permission to perform from the Ministry of Guidance. But arrest and jailing was a real fear. And Behrouz believes that he was spared both because of the compassion of some citizens who were there to save him and get him out of the area, but also by a little bit of luck.
A wedding singer, unlike most wedding singers we know in the United States.
Isn't it fascinating what they have to go through just to sing and to be happy? طاقت همه به سر اومده ببین چه بلایی سر کشور اومده همه زندگی یا به یه موبنده دیگه شنیده نمیشه صدای خنده خفقان سر.
That's Iranian singer Behrouz Ghaemi. Marjan, I mentioned earlier how a lot of Iranian musicians, if they cross a certain, often unclear line, they can be imprisoned. That's the case with a female rapper on this compilation. Her stage name is Justina. Tell us about her.
She has had to endure her own share of struggles and censorship in order to emerge from the underground music scene in Iran. Justina was taken to interrogations frequently, and she was reprimanded for singing not only as a female vocalist and a rapper, but also because of the subject of her songs, which often have to do with empowerment of women. خوشا روزا که ما مشوقه را مهمان کنیم دیده از روی نگارینش نگارستان کنیم گرز داغ هجره او دردیست در دلهای ما سه افتاب روی او آن درد را درمان کنیم چون به دست ما. Let me ask you finally, Marjan, about the age range of a lot of the musicians on the album. I'm wondering if it's young up-and-coming artists who make up the large majority of musicians who feel under the thumb of the regime, and what is that about? So most of the artists that we have curated for this album are emerging artists with a lot, with very robust fan bases inside Iran. But we wanted to reach out to broader audiences and also the older Iranian audiences. So for that reason, we have asked Hassan Sattar, who is one of the most revered Iranian vocalists and started his career in the pre-revolution Iran, to contribute a song to the album. We were delighted when Mr. Sattar accepted our invitation and decided to contribute a song to the album.
What is his song about?
His song, Farqi Nemi Kone, which means it makes no difference. Farqi Nemi Kone is a call for unity and love among all people, especially the people of Iran. And I couldn't think of a better way for humanity and harmony to come together than this song by Mr. Sattar. Farqi Nemi Kone, ke dinemun chiye. الگوی هر کسی تو زندگی کیه.
We go out with the Iranian vocalist Sattar today. Sattar, one of many artists on a new compilation called Humanity, which aims to raise awareness about censorship and persecution of artists in Iran. Marjan Kapoor Greenblatt helped compile the album. Marjan, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Marco. از منظر خدا با هم برابریم، از منظر خدا با هم برابریم. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman.
As always these days, be safe, stay strong, and enjoy the weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.